Thank you for coming this morning. We have our last plenaries, and it is our big pleasure this morning to present our speakers from this last day. Our plenaries from today are about conservation on the ground. Both include aspects of conservation in practice, also outside Europe. Our first speaker is Virgilio Hermoso. Virgilio is currently a postdoctoral researcher and in the program Ramón y Cajal at the Forest Science Center of Catalonia. He started as a fish ecologist, focused on native species conservation, alien species and their interactions. Later, in Australia, at the University of Queensland and at Griffith University, he discovered conservation planning and its application to freshwater ecosystems. Since then, he has applied conservation planning to help taking decisions for the conservation of aquatic biodiversity in Bhutan, in India, or the Democratic Republic of Congo. Today, he will talk about the future of freshwater ecosystems, utopia or dystopia in the face of climate change. Our pleasure, Virgilio.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks, Nuria, for the kind introduction, and thanks. I would like to start by thanking the organizing committee for giving me the opportunity to be here this morning and bring the freshwater freshwater ecosystems to the front page of this important conference in Europe, because this is it's actually one of the realms that are less covered in this kind of conservation conferences. So thanks so much. And thanks, everyone, for coming this morning. I know that it's the last day, first thing in the morning, so I really appreciate that you're here. So my talk this morning, behind this kind of cryptic title, actually I'm going to talk about spatial conservation prioritization. I hope I didn't let you down already, and hopefully it won't be too bad. So if we look up the meaning of these two words that I have on my title, we see that an utopia is an ideal imagined place in which everything is perfect, and a dystopia is actually the opposite, an imagined place in which everything is unpleasant and typically environmentally degraded. We actually can skip the word "imagine" from the description of the word. Actually, we are all familiar. Probably most of us grew up in areas where we had access to this kind of really nice freshwater environments, but unfortunately, we are privileged people in the world, in the planet. Because most of people only have access to this kind of really degraded environments that I would already call dystopia. So these people live in a dystopic environment world. and these kind of situations are increasingly becoming more common because of the high pressure that we are submitting these freshwater ecosystems all around the world. And these pressures are increasing because of increasing human population and increasing raising demand on freshwater resources. So are we doomed to this kind of situations, dystopic situations, to become more common in the future? Hopefully we won't. And my talk will be focused on how can we help to avoid these kind of situations. So freshwater ecosystems are incredibly biodiverse. Just four taxonomic groups here, like for example, there's more than 15,000 freshwater fish described today, and it's a not very well known taxa because we keep describing more and more species every single year. For example, there's more than 5,000 dragonfly species, amphibians, etc. In total, there's more than 126,000 species described related to freshwater ecosystems, which is quite exceptional if we think of the really small, narrow strips that freshwater ecosystems occupy in the world. They represent less or just a little bit more than 1% of the total, the Earth's surface. So we have a really high concentration of biodiversity in a really small strip of land area in the planet. But freshwater ecosystems are also really important for us humans. They provide us with critical ecosystem services and resources. These are just some pictures of some of these resources and ecosystem services that we receive from these ecosystems, which is probably one of the reasons why the current conservation status of these systems is so bad. Like, we have been really successful at modifying these systems on our own benefit. Currently, we have control on more than 50% of all the water, fresh water, running through rivers in the world. And you can see that there's some areas where it's especially bad. The U.S., most of Europe, India, China. The current conservation status of freshwater systems is really bad. And this picture is becoming worse and worse every year because, as I said at the beginning of my talk, there's increasing pressure on these systems. We demand more resources, and we disturb these systems more and more every year. So looking at the European freshwater biodiversity, here I'm just showing three taxa, like freshwater fish, ordinates, and mollusks. That would be the spatial distribution. These taxonomic groups are kind of more or less well-known, well-studied. For example, for freshwater fish diversity, we have like 550 species described in Europe. Ordinates about 140 species, and freshwater mollusks about 850 species. So this is kind of a really high diverse taxonomic group. You see that there's kind of common distribution patterns of species richness. Mainly Central Europe tends to be higher in richness. But when we look at the conservation status, the threatened status of these species, we also see kind of common patterns, like towards southern, the Mediterranean rim, where we have the highest concentration of threatened species. This is mostly related to the degree of endemicity. Like in Central Europe, we have more species, but they're more common, while in around the Mediterranean basin, we have less, but they are rarer and more endemic. When we check the conservation status of these species, we see that, for example, 37% of freshwater fish are either critically endangered, endangered, or vulnerable, 15% of ordinates, and 44% of freshwater mollusks. These proportions are among the highest cited in across any kind of taxonomic group that has been already evaluated, and not only in Europe, across the world. So that is showing us that we have our freshwater biodiversity is actually highly endangered at the continental scale, at the global scale, sorry. And this is despite the huge effort that we have already done in terms of conservation. Like we're all familiar with the Natura 2000. We have covered like 18% of all the land masses and freshwater systems in Europe. But still, seems like we're not doing very well in terms of conservation. So our conservation efforts are not being that successful. And there might be some reasons. There might be lots of different reasons. Today, I will only focus on those reasons related to the spatial planning. Okay, I'm not going to talk about how effectively these protected areas are managed or not. I'm just going to focus on how well they are designed or not from a spatial point of view. Okay, so that's to illustrate one of the problems, in my view, of this Natura 2000 network. I'm going to use the case of the Iberian Peninsula. So here we have already covered 25% of the whole Iberian Peninsula, terrestrial area, and also freshwater systems, again. So 25% of our rivers and streams are within protected areas already. we have gone already over the Aichi target, so we're doing really well. But when we check the representativeness, which is how well this network of protected areas cover freshwater biodiversity, we find situations like this. This is a critically endangered species. We have only a few remaining populations along the Mediterranean coast. And only 7% of that really narrow distribution is covered under Natura 2000. But the situation gets even worse because there's some species that never occur within Natura 2000. So obviously there is a representation gap of our network of protected areas. Interestingly enough, if we spread this 25% randomly across the Iberian Peninsula, this kind of situation hardly ever happen. So basically means that in terms of covering freshwater biodiversity, it seems that we're not doing better than random. Like, we could have spread our conservation efforts randomly, and we would have done better than this in terms of representing freshwater biodiversity. Again, Natura 2000 is not only about freshwater, okay? When trying to protect biodiversity, we should not only worry about representing patterns of species distributions, like trying to cover species, but also the processes that sustain that biodiversity that we're interested in protecting. And in freshwater systems, one of the key ecological processes that we need to look after is the longitudinal connectivity. Okay, longitudinal connectivity is key for maintaining processes like migrations. We need to let fish and turtles and any other kind of species to move and complete their biological cycles. Longitudinal connectivity is also key at maintaining the transfer of energy and material along the river network, which is also critical for sustaining healthy freshwater systems. But also, from a management point of view, longitudinal connectivity is critical to consider how threats propagate along the river network. Like, if we wanted to protect those species over there, but we didn't consider that there might be threats coming from upstream areas, our conservation efforts might be completely ineffective. So that's why longitudinal connectivity is critical when designing effective protected areas for freshwater biodiversity. But not the only one. There's more processes. Another one that we also worry about is lateral connectivity. Like, there's some freshwater species that are not strictly water, restricted to the water. So they can actually move aerially or terrestrially. So we also need to worry about other processes related to that lateral connectivity. When we check the spatial design of this Natura 2000, we find that actually there's lots of things that might not actually work in terms of effective conservation for freshwater biodiversity, things that happen very often. And this is, I just focus here, did a zoom in a particular area, random area actually, of Natura 2000 in the Iberian Peninsula. So we see here, these are really good examples of things that we normally do. Like, we use rivers as to define the boundaries of protected areas. Unfortunately, that's not good for freshwater because we're protecting just one side of the river, the other one is unprotected, so we might still get threats affecting whatever we want to protect in that river reach. We also use rivers as corridors, this is actually a really interesting option in terms of fostering connectivity for terrestrial biodiversity, but unfortunately, again, for the same reason, we're not effectively protecting whatever is just in the river there. And then, overall, there's really bad overlap of hydrologically sensitive units and their boundaries of our protected area. So very commonly, that we have rivers that are protected within protected areas that have, for example, headwaters that are outside the protected area. So that basically means that whatever we are supposed to protect here might be affected by threats propagating, as I showed on my previous slide, from upstream regions, for example. So in this particular case, like this protected area here, as you can see, funny enough here, they left out the river. They left the river out of the protected areas. It's probably because there were some kind of interest in future development. I don't know exactly that one. So to make it actually sensible in terms of freshwater conservation, that protected area should actually look more like that. You know, that's what we propose. So when we incorporate this longitudinal, lateral connectivity in conservation planning, we find solutions like this. This is an example from Northern Australia. I just zoom in. We ran, for this particular case study, what we did, we just predicted the spatial distribution of more than 300 freshwater-related species, fish, turtles, and water birds. And then we asked, in this particular case, Markson, can you identify a minimum set of areas that complement whatever we already have in place, like these are already existing protected areas? Can you find a minimum set of river reaches that should be incorporated into that network so we improve the representativeness of our network and also the spatial design in terms of lateral and longitudinal connectivity? So basically what Markson did in this particular case, as you can see, this is Kakadu National Park, one of the iconic protected areas in Australia, northern Australia. So here what Markson thought it was that, oh, maybe it's a good idea to actually incorporate all these headwaters that are running into the wetlands that we are protecting here, so we improve longitudinal connectivity. Also, we have another wetland here that is actually not protected now, close to these others that are, so maybe that's a good way of improving lateral connectivity, and so on. So these are the kinds of solutions. This is how we can actually improve the spatial design of our networks of protected areas. Going back to the example of the Iberian Peninsula, we did exactly the same. We asked Markson, where are the key spots, the priority areas that we should add to overcome those problems that I just mentioned in terms of representation and spatial design? Markson thought that these areas in orange are the ones that would be priority to be added, so we improve the situation. That means actually we need to increase the total area to be protected in the Iberian Peninsula up to 30%. So obviously, if we think of managing freshwater systems for conservation in following the traditional concept of protected areas, that area has to be the whole area has to be specially managed for conservation, it's actually quite hard to implement and hard to convince stakeholders that we need to add all those orange spots on a system that is already exhausted. Like, we are already protecting 25% of our territory. So that's the reason why we're moving beyond this kind of binary concept of, in terms of conservation planning, like protect or not. We're moving beyond that to a more flexible approach that we call multi-zoning, where we do not only spatially prioritize areas for conservation or not, we actually prioritize the spatial distribution of different management zones. Here, this is just one example where we have three different management zones, something we call, it's actually a conservation schedule proposed by Abel et al. 10 years ago already, where we have freshwater focal areas, where they call freshwater focal areas, which are the areas that have to be strictly managed for conservation because we have endemic species or whatever we want to preserve that is high sensitive to degradation. Then we have critical management zones that are zones that are that are really important for maintaining ecological processes. For example, let's imagine that we need to maintain like migrations between this area and that other one. So this area doesn't need to be strictly protected. It just needs to be specially managed so we maintain those processes that are key. And then they also propose this catchment management zone, which is all the upstream area that, again, doesn't need to be all the upstream area, sorry, to every single freshwater focal area that needs to be specially managed, again, doesn't need to be strictly protected. Okay, so by applying these kind of more flexible schedules, where we see that we can reduce the pressure for strict conservation a lot. Just focusing on one of the threats that is gaining more and more importance is hydropower. I'm sorry that I'm running out of time, and I still have quite a bit. So hydropower is gaining more and more relevance in terms of conservation all around the world. Hydropower is considered, it's actually the main source of green energy. Like 80% of the green energy we produce in the world comes from hydropower, and this is becoming more and more important. Here, for example, we have the distribution of all these hydropower dams that are either planned or under construction. And yeah, you see that there's actually a lot of stuff going on already, especially in China and India, and a lot of hydropower plants. This can be a really serious conservation problem for freshwater biodiversity because some of these dams are located in also the most diverse biodiverse rivers in the world. So basically, we might be threatening a large portion of the last wild rivers and also biodiversity in the world. Focusing, for example, in Europe, the Balkans area is probably one of the hotspots right now in terms of hydropower development. They are planning to build in the next few years up, I think it's nearly 3,000 new hydropower dams. And obviously, this is going to be a serious conservation problem for the region, which, by the way, is one of the hotspots for freshwater biodiversity at the continental scale. So that's a serious conservation problem. And yeah, obviously, most of these dams actually overlap with protected areas, so they don't care about the conservation status of an area in terms of planning for hydropower. I'm going to skip this. So most of our research has actually been focusing on a reactive approach. Like we have the problem and we're trying to fix the problem. Like in terms of hydropower, for example, or dams, river regulation in particular, where are those dams that we need to remove to improve connectivity, or how do we manage those dams to minimize the impact of these dams on biodiversity. However, I think that we should be more proactive and start thinking about how can we minimize the impact of this development that is, unfortunately, it's going to happen somehow. So, and also make the most of the opportunity that this concept of ecosystem services might bring us. Obviously, we have the challenge from a spatial prioritization point of view that how do we minimize the negative impacts of this granting access, for example, to water or energy production. But as I mentioned, we also have a really interesting opportunity in terms of conservation because by maintaining these ecosystem services, we might create new conservation opportunities for biodiversity. From a spatial planning point of view, what does it mean? Basically, we're interested in, it's a complicated puzzle that we need to solve. Basically, what we want to do is to identify areas at the catchment scale where we can foster these kind of synergies or co-benefits. Where can we protect or maintain these services that also bring the most conservation value for biodiversity, and where in the catchment do we allocate or do we grant access to these other services that might be impacting on biodiversity and the other services. And how do we do it? So we minimize that impact. So just very quickly, because I ran out of time, we have done something like that in Australia. It's another catchment in northern Australia where we had the distribution of all these species. We mapped four different ecosystem services, some of them impacting and some of them, let's call them good or for biodiversity conservation. And then we asked, again, Marksan, how can we organize different kinds of management zones across the whole catchment so we allow exploring those ecosystem services but minimizing the impact on freshwater biodiversity. Again, because I run out of time, I won't go much in detail on this. If you're interested, we can talk about that later. And just going back to my first slide, just to send a positive message, because I don't want you to think that, yeah, we are actually doomed to this dystopic scenarios. There's really interesting approaches and initiatives blooming everywhere across the planet, like things like water reserves. This concept is linked to the ecosystem services, basically protecting headwaters of catchments that provide us with clean water. Things like, I'm not sure if you have heard of these kind of initiatives that, for example, New Zealand or India are granting legal rights to rivers so we can treat rivers as humans. That's kind of interesting. And also, like, we are reacting, as I said, to this really serious problem in terms of river regulation, and these kind of things are becoming more and more common. And I wouldn't like to finish without saying a really big thanks to all those people, and I think that Luis is also going to talk about this later, all those people that are fighting, even risking their lives, for protecting and saving the least that we still have and of freshwater ecosystems in the world. This is Berta Cáceres. I'm not sure if you have heard of her, but she was killed like 2 years ago while she was defending a river reach in Honduras against the development of a hydropower plant. So I think that, yeah, these people deserve more and more attention. And with this, I finish before Nuria kills me.
Thank you very much, Virgilio, for bringing us to freshwater ecosystems and to people behind conservation also, that sometimes we forget. We have time for one very fast question. Okay, so maybe we can pass them later, and yeah, if we have time, then we can answer later. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Luis Arranz. I would like to give him very special thanks for his efforts to come here. I know that I have been very insisting, but it's really for him a big effort and many hours of traveling to come here. Luis was born in the Canary Islands. He studied biology in the Autonomous University of Madrid. And in 1980, he started to work in Equatorial Guinea, first doing tree censuses and then for the project Men and Nature, funded by the Spanish Corporation, to create a network of protected areas in the country. Between 1986 and 1990, he worked in South America, preparing the management plan for Huachanca National Park, now the Noel Kef Mercado National Park in Bolivia, and evaluating sites for the creation of protected areas in Bolivia, Brazil, and Venezuela. In 1991, he returned to Africa. He has worked in Kisama National Park in Angola 1 year, 9 years in Monte Alen National Park in Equatorial Guinea as director, 7 years as director in Sakoma National Park in Chad, 7 years as director in Garamba National Park in the Republic of Congo, and 3 months as interim director in Otsala Cocoa National Park in Congo Republic. Since January 2017, he works for WWF in Danga-Shanga protected areas in the Central African Republic. Today, in his talk, he will share with us his 38 years of experience in the creation and management of protected areas of South America and Africa, the problems and challenges faced, and discuss solutions. Welcome, Luis.
Good morning to everybody. Sorry. Good morning to everybody. First of all, I want to thank for inviting me here, and thank you for coming. And excuse me for my English, it's not very good, but I am going to try what happened in Africa in this moment. I know that my conference will be a little bit different, but somebody will like, somebody will don't like, but it's the truth. It's the truth that is happening. I am going to base my conference in the three last part where I have worked. I have worked in Sakuma National Park, is in Chad, in Garamba National Park, in the northeast of Republic Democratic of Congo, and in Sanga-Sanga protected areas in Central African Republic. Sakuma is here. It's a wonderful park where we can still see a group of 100 elephants. We can see seven that is like cattle. You can see a lot of elephants, but also you can see that every day we have a lot of problems with elephants. That is the result of one of the problems. That is the truth. And that is not when the ranger find the porche, you can see that there is not a joke. There are some pictures hard. That is one of the porche. That is one of the 11 rangers that I lost during 7 years in Sakuma. That is the guns that we recover from the porche, even a gun machine. Don't you can see that when the title of the conference is "The War of the Conservation," is not exaggeration. It's the truth. In Garamba National Park, it's still war. It's in the northeast of Congo, border with South Sudan, border with Uganda, and there are also a lot of elephants. You can see 3,000 elephants, not together, but you can find group of 2,000-3,000 elephants, but it's always the same problem. We have a lot of problems with poachers. We had a lot of problems with poachers. The poachers, when they find the ranger, that is the result. They attack sometimes our helicopter. That they destroy 2 planes, 3 cars, and kill 23 people. That is one of the poachers. In this case, we see that is one of the army, the Congo army. That is one of the 32 rangers that I lost in 7 years in Garamba, and that is the gun that we recovered from the poachers. Don't you can see that? I see it's really war. This is one of the rangers, our ranger that go to her. You see that the ranger go like in the war, and in Garamba also we have some visit from helicopter coming from South Sudan that came for killing elephant from the helicopter. And we have also, Garamba is the place of the LRA, Low Resistance Army of Joseph Kony. It's a group, a rebel group. They have killed more than 10,000 people, and they have kidnapped more than 23,000 children in his life. Then every time that you can see here, a couple of adults with the guns, and the other are children that they came from a village from kidnap them. Every time that we find a group like this, we start to shoot to the air, and the adults run. The children, if they are clever, they hide, and then we recover some of them. We recover in 7 years about 120 children, but they have kidnapped 23,000. Then it's nothing, as you can see. And the last part is Sanga-Sanga protected areas. It's just in the border in Central African Republic with Cameroon and Congo. There are 2 national parks, Sanga Ndoki and Protect Reserve. and there are also a bay is a clear in the forest that you can find anywhere, at any time 100 to 200 forest elephant. It's the only place in the world that you can find. All that picture are from this month, that last month, so it's everything is from now. Don't, what is the problem? The problem, the first thing is to recognize the problem, and that is a war, and we are losing it. I don't know that nobody want to like to speak about losing something, but we are losing the war. What do we need? We need political will. That means we need time, we need money, and we need the more important to use the money for what is really necessary. So political will implicate the government to work only in countries where they really want to save the parks. That means that there are a lot of parks in Africa. First of all, I want to say that I am speaking about Africa, not about the rest of the world, because I don't know. I don't like to speak about things that I don't know. But in Africa, there are some governments that really want to protect the park, and there are other governments that doesn't want. Don't we need to choose, because we have not enough money for work in every park, and we have to try to work just in the countries that they work. In Rwanda, the president really want to protect. In Chad, the president want to protect. In Benin, the president want to protect. But there are some countries like in Angola or like the Democratic Republic of Congo, they don't want. They don't want. That is, for me, it's idiot to continue spending money if they really don't want. Another thing is to force them to fulfill the obligation. That means sometimes we sign a contract with the government to say, okay, we are going to put 2-3 million euros for conservation and park, but you have to put some people, or you have to give some guns, or you have to do something. At the end of the day, we put everything, they put nothing, but nobody want to have problems with them, and okay, it doesn't matter, and we must go to continue working like that. And the third thing is to allow us to work. So who must do it? People working on the field, we can't. It's impossible. We have a lot of things to do, so it's impossible. Must do it for government, cooperation agency, donors, and big organization. That we have in the park, we have to do everything. I am going to for an example, last 3 years ago, we have to make a report of the last seven years in Garamba. So I have to tell how many elephants we have, a lot of things about conservation. But furthermore, everything, the European Union asks us what we have done for human rights, gender equality, democracy, good governance, children's rights, indigenous people's rights, and fight against HIV. And we are lucky because that was before the Ebola crisis. If not, we have to do or something for the Ebola crisis. For instance, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, there are United Nations, it is the MONUSCO. They have a budget of $7 million per day. We in Garamba had a budget of $2 million per year. So the difference is quite big. But we have to do everything. And I think that it's just impossible. If I have to defend the elephant, I can state that the children have the right, that we have a lot, we do a lot of things. We make health, we make education, we make a lot of things. But it's impossible to change a country like with 40 million people, with a lot of problems, and it's impossible. I think that for us, the more important thing is to keep the park, and maybe someday, if the country changes, the park and the elephant will be still there. If not, everything will be lost. Suddenly we have not so much. I think I started to work in conservation near 40 years ago, and I think that we have done a lot of bad things. But till now we have time. We have 20,000 elephants. Okay, after 5 years we have 20 elephants, then 15,000 elephants, then 10,000 elephants. But now we are in a moment that if we don't change quickly, we are going to lose everything. And the other thing that we is continuity. That is, we need long-term funds. That means that every time that we have funds for protect a park, we have for 2-3 years. After 2-3 years, we don't know if we are going to have more money. And even if we can possibility to get more money, we have to spend half of the time working, asking for more money, for more money, for more money. So at the end of the day, it's a little bit ridiculous. As I told you, I arrived in Africa, at Africa 40 years ago, nothing has changed. So we can't think that in 2 years everything will be okay. The other thing that we need is money. Money, for me, is not the big problem. There are a lot of money for conservation. The problem is that most of the problem go to I don't know where. That means I think that for every $100 that people go for conservation, maybe 20 or 25 arrive to the parks. The rest, I don't know where they go. The big organization prefer to do big congress that protect the park. For instance, in Garamba, in 2007, we made a radio survey. We count in the time in 1960 there were about 1,200 white rhino, northern white rhino. In 2004 there were 5 northern white rhino. Don't we propose to do something? Don't the first thing that the people say we are going to be a big congress in Kinshasa to protect the white rhino. Everybody came from everywhere, specialists. For 3-4 days, everybody speak about the rhino, how to protect the rhino. The World Bank say, I'm going to give money for protecting the rhino. We are going to prepare a project. I don't want to. After 4 years, the money arrived to protect the rhino. After 4 years, no one rhino was in Garamba National Park. So it's sometimes it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. We have to act in the moment. We can't wait years and years and years for that. And another thing is that most of the money that the organization receives must be used for get more money. I say the big organization like WWF, where I work, African Park, WCS, everything, there are more people working in here in Europe, in the United States, asking for money than the money that they send to the park. I think that is a little bit also ridiculous. If we receive 20 million euros for protecting 12 or 15 million euros, have to pay the people that are asking for more money. And when the money arrives to the park, it's really, really not enough. And we have to lie to get the money. I need money for protect the elephant for 3 years, but after 3 years, we'll be exactly in the same position that we are now. Everybody know that, but I can't say that. I have to say, no, after 3 years, everybody will be perfect, the people will be happy, the elephant will be happy, everybody know that I am lying, but okay, I give them money. After 3 years, I have to say the same thing all the time. So I think that there is a little bit hypocrisy. That is an example that I want to put. In 2008, I got some funds from the Spanish cooperation for Garamba to protect the chimps. So they couldn't give us the money directly, and they go through UNEP, a grass project. Don't they give 200,000 euros? They get to say, after 1 year, please give me the money. Yes, but there are a problem. After 7 years, they told me, the reality is that UNEP support program no longer exists. I'm sorry that the money arrived to UNEP for us. They spend I don't know where, and the money finished. And nothing happened. It's a big organization. It's United Nations. We continue like that. Another thing is that the money, we have to use the money for what is really necessary. To prepare a project is a mission near impossible. And objectives are incomprehensible and activity biodegradable. When I say biodegradable, I say that there are a lot of projects, a lot of activities that you go to the park, you make the activity, you stop, 3 years later you go there and you find absolutely nothing. Though we have the money. So you say, my objective is to protect Sangha Sangha, or to protect the park, they are going to say, no, I have to say, strength, existing consultation, blah, 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 blah. And like this, there are 200, 300 different activities. So use the money is, mostly of the time, we already know what to do. We don't need a lot of the study. We don't need a lot of consultant. We need only money to, for us. We, like park managing, we have no time to work because we had to do a lot of report, evaluation, everything. And we need guns and ammunition. We need, that is, in Congo, I have to go with money in the pot to buy guns illegally because I can't present an invoice of guns in the European community. So I have to say that I am going to buy soap. I buy soap, I give the soap to the army, and the army gave me money. So I'm a trafficker, but it's the only way. And there are the bad news, everything. The good news, we are still speaking about it. We are speaking still because the elephant at the park still exists. They exist because we are there, and we are there because there are people giving us money. Then there are three options for me. One is to stop and lose everything. Second, to continue like now and lose near everything. And third is to change the way of work. Now I would like to, because I have worked a lot, I have spoke a lot, I would like to show you why I am there. We are there in Africa, why we are risking our life, why we are losing a lot of people. So I want to present some pictures about Sangha Sangha, and then if you have some question, you can put the small video. only thing Central African Republic has about 600,000 square kilometers. Sangasanga, he has about 4,000 square kilometers. It's the only place in the country that we can find still that. If we lose that, we lose everything. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Luis, for bringing us to reality. Are there some questions in the room? Okay, please.
Hi. Thank you for your talk. Sorry, I'm gonna read off. I just want to be really clear about what I'm saying here. I was wondering a bit about the language and the visuals that you're using, specifically with the terminology of using the war on poaching and the war of conservation. The language is very similar to the war on drugs or the war on terror, which are very have been shown to be very racially charged systems of oppression that have come from at least the U.S., but other areas. Related to this, I'm a bit concerned about the rise of militarization in conservation. I recognize that obviously you are facing specific threat from specific outside force, but overall the trend is to treat a social problem, that is, the forces driving local people to poach, or not just local people, but in general, with a military solution. And there is a colonial power imbalance to that, to this militarization. And I want to be clear that I am very interested in the intrinsic value of biodiversity, and I cherish all the photos that you've just shared. But I also worry about how conservation is oftentimes used as a colonial tool. Have you thought about that with the context of your work?
Okay, I think the question, if I understand, is that you suggest or you are one that Luis will comment if this conservation is a colonial way. Can you make the question clear?
You ask if we are like colonialists or something like that.
In a way, conservation can be used as a colonial.
I think that it's a problem that everybody say, when I speak about guns and ammunition, I don't want guns to kill the poachers. I want guns to protect the people that is protecting the elephant. And the poachers come ready to kill the ranger. I have lost more than 40 rangers in Garamba, more than 50 rangers. And the first thing is that we work for the government. We don't go there to protect the park because we want. The government asks us for protect the park. And the same thing that I think here in Finland, in Europe, the police say, we have to protect a bank. And if the robber go to try to rob the bank, the police is going to say, no, don't do that. If the guy take a gun, the police will take a gun. And because it's better, I think, that the robber died than the police. And there is exactly the same thing. We work a lot with the people. We make a lot of education. We try to do a lot of things. But if the poachers come from South Sudan, from Chad, with a caravan of 10, 15 poachers with guns ready to kill everything, what can we do? The law say here in Europe that you can't kill a bear or something like that. The law say in Africa that you can't kill an elephant.
Again, I think I understand all that. I think it's really important to understand that the robber didn't just rob a bank out of nowhere. Sometimes there are very malicious people. A lot of the times there is context behind that, and I think there is context behind why people are driven to poaching and driven to get into those situations, and there is a historical context, and again, that power imbalance that has come from generations and centuries of the history of the place.
Okay, thank you very much. I think, Per, you have some questions?
Hello, I'm Per Sjögren-Gulve from the Swedish Environmental Protection Agency. I've been working in the government agency for more than 20 years, and I think I see some common patterns that I've seen before also. I might not be addressing this last presentation so much, but the general phenomenon, I was also thinking of Virgilio's presentation with respect to the exploitation of freshwater resources and water plants, power plants building in the southeastern Europe. I think it's very important that people that are doing very good research, like within the Society for Conservation Biology and other associations, to partner up with other NGOs and also to try to reach very critical points in the political and administrative systems, because there are possibilities to really make something else happen. Then it seems to me that there are many things that are being hijacked by some entrepreneur interests and some lobby groups for some purposes, and we are not efficient enough from our side to really make something else happen, to provide evidence, to provide other things that can really make the direction turn another way in the development instead of just deteriorating the biodiversity.
Okay, thank you. Was rather a comment. Okay, I think we don't have time for more questions. Thank you very much, Luis, for coming and showing us, sharing your experience with us. Thank you very much.
Okay, my name is Merja Elo. I'm a member of the local organizing committee. I must admit, I feel a bit ridiculous to speak about these small things after Luis Arans forced us to look outside the bubble of the classrooms. But there are some things that you should take on today. First, if you chaired on entomological session, you can suggest a special issue from it to the journal Insects. And then we have about 20 T-shirts waiting for the owner in the information desk. So if you have bought one, please come and get them. We will start selling them after lunch break to anyone. So if you have paid already, please come and get them. And there are also plenty of abstract books abandoned in the information desk, so you can get one for free if you want to. Today there is evening plenary here, 5 o'clock, and this plenary is also open for a wider audience, so don't be surprised if there are some people who have not these lanyards. And then the banquet dinner in Sataman Yö, it starts at 7 o'clock, doors open 6:45. There is a cloaker room and it costs €3, and you should leave all your stuff there. I mean all, the posters, and even the water bottles. It is a common festival area, you cannot carry anything with you. And please return these lanyards and name tags before you leave. We will reuse them. And on the behalf of the local organizing committee, I would like to thank first the people giving us course proposals and actually sharing their expertise by giving the course. And then the people who offered couches by couch surfing, so people had place to sleep. And last but not leastly, the organizing committee would like to thank all the volunteers, the Congress assistants who have worked here on the lecture halls and on the information desk and on the speaker room, because this Congress won't be happening without you. And just before the coffee, the biodiversity offsets, we have got 5,140 euros as offsetting payments. If you want to raise this up, you still have some time. Okay, now we will have coffee. Thank you.